I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. You might recall this past June reading and watching some of the commemorations of the 50th anniversary of the collapse of the Second Narrows Bridge. Now a detailed and highly readable account is out describing what happened on the 17th of June 1958 and in its aftermath, where 18 people lost their lives. There was a tremendous amount of research done unraveling what happened and what remains one of Vancouver's great mysteries. The author of Tragedy at Second Narrows, the story of the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge, Eric Jameson, joins me now. This is his second book, and it makes for gripping reading. From Harbor Publishing, the book retails for $32.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Eric Jameson. Good morning, Mr. Jameson.
Hi, Joe. Please call me Eric, and thanks for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. What brought you to write this book?
Well, you know, I was about a month away from my ninth birthday, and for some reason, I remember it, and it resonated in my mind, and my wife and I, of course, I grew up and, you know, went to school, went to UBC, and didn't give it much thought, but then my wife and I moved away, and I started writing, and every time we come back to Vancouver, I would cross the bridge, and I'd think, yeah, I remember this, and what happened? I mean, bridges just don't fall down, right? So it always sort of, as I said, resonated in my mind as an unusual event that needed some investigation. And so when I retired at the grand old age of 55 from my banking career, I immediately tackled it and started working on it right away. And it's taken me 4 years, actually, to finish the book.
You spent your career in banking.
Yeah, I was with the Business Development Bank of Canada. I was a bank manager with them for 28-odd years, and then I spent a number of years with other banking organizations prior to that.
But you've sat on boards of museums and so on?
Yeah, I was 18 years on the boards of museums. I was 6 years with the Campbell River Museum Society. I'm not sure if that's the correct name of it anymore, but I was 6 years on the Prince George Museum, and then 6 years with the North Shore Museum.
So you've had a great interest in history throughout your life, right?
Yeah, always. I've always, not always. I mean, I started writing outdoor articles and fly fishing, fishing. I had a fly fishing column in a magazine. Used to write, fishing articles, outdoor articles, hiking articles, things like that. But then I sort of graduated into my love with history, and I've been writing history ever since.
When you started this book 4 years ago, did you think to yourself that maybe I could solve this, that there's something that I could come up with that we didn't know before?
Well, I always thought that there might be a smoking gun somewhere, but, and nobody had ever investigated it to try to find it. But, you know, there was no smoking gun. There are a set of circumstances that are never reported. It's always every June, it's always the young engineer made the error and the senior engineer missed it. But, you know, there were contributory factors that were brought out in the Royal Commission, and they're never really reported because it would take a long time, and it's a very technical thing to explain everything that went on. And so I don't say the columnists and journalists that do report every June are wrong. They're not wrong. But they do tend to take the easy route, I guess, when it comes to reporting exactly what went on.
There's a Jameson in the book that you write about. He was an engineer, was he?
Don Jameson, yeah.
Yeah, are you related to him?
No, absolutely not. And interesting, he spells his name the same way as I do, which is not a common Jameson spelling. I-E is not the common way. There's a lot of Jamesons around. There's E-S-O-N and I-S-O-N, but I-E is, there aren't that many of us, and it's kind of a coincidence. I asked the son, Matt, whether, about his family background, and I suppose we're related a long time ago, right, but no direct relation, no.
But there is someone in your family that is related to someone who was involved, right?
That's correct, yeah. Do you want me to tell you that story?
Yeah, would you?
Yeah. I was about a month retired, and I was building a pergola out in the backyard over my patio. And my young son, Ian, came out of the house with a girl in tow, and her name was Carly. And she asked, my son introduced her to me, and he asked, she asked what I was doing. And after explaining what the pergola was, we started talking about the book. And she said, oh, my family was impacted by that. and she said, my granduncle, Alan Stewart, died on the bridge, and his body was never recovered. And she said, my grandmother, Peggy, knows all about the collapse and knows all the men. And I said, oh, my God, I've got to meet her, because I was having trouble at that point making any contacts of the survivors. And so I met Peggy, had her over to the house, and she's a dear woman. And she was married to an iron worker, Wayne, and her father-in-law at that time was Sid, who was also an iron worker, Sid Stewart. And so when she gave me a bunch of names, and I went to the doors of these people like Norm Atkinson and Lou Lessard, and I dropped Peggy Stewart's name, the doors opened, and people were very receptive. They gave me other names, and I was sort of part of this family of bridge people suddenly. And it was quite overwhelming, actually, you know, and it's carried on right through. And I have a lot of, I've got to give Peggy a lot of gratitude to, you know, for introducing me to the family, sort of thing.
And Carly's part of your family now, is
Carly,
she?
Yeah, my son married Carly, and she's part of the family, you know. So it worked out. And I had the privilege of carrying Alan Stewart's wreath down to the cenotaph from at the memorial on June 17th, 2008, which is the 50th anniversary of the collapse.
Let's go back 50 years or more. How did this bridge come to be?
Well, how did it come to be?
Yeah, was it they just needed another crossing across the whatever?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's North Vancouver 50 years ago. I don't know if you were around then, but east end of North Vancouver was slowly being developed. There were subdivision after subdivision going in, and it's, you know, interesting that my dad, we moved here in 1955, I think, was right around this time, and the subdivision Forest Hills, which is just above Highland Boulevard, was just, you know, there were homes being built in there, and there was bush gradually being bulldozed away, and so all of North Vancouver was being developed because as a bedroom community to Vancouver, right? So you had two crossings across the Burrard Inlet at that time. You had the Lions Gate, three lanes, and then you had the old Second Narrows Bridge over the Second Narrows, and it had, you know, the two roadways on either side of the bridge, and then running through the middle of the bridge were the tracks, the rail tracks. And that bridge, just to give you an idea of the number of interruptions on that bridge, in 1952 they clocked, or they recorded 28,400 ships passing under that span, which caused the span to be opened, the lift span to be lifted up 5,300 times. Then there were two rail interruptions a day. So in total per day, that averages out to 16 interruptions a day. So you can imagine that you're trying to get down to Vancouver very quickly, and suddenly a ship wants passage, so the gates drop, and, you know, you're probably 10 minutes waiting there to get across. Very frustrating. And so the only option for people living in the east part of North Vancouver was the Lions Gate Bridge. And it was a long way away from, you know, if you lived in Seymour area or Deep Cove or whatever, it was a long way away. So another bridge was definitely needed, and the ratepayers associations were crying out for another bridge. And so a crossing study was implemented in about 1953-54, and it was made up of the various reeves and mayors of the districts and on the North Shore and the city on the North Shore and Vancouver City, and individuals from the two bridge companies, the Guinness family, which owned the Lionsgate Bridge, provided a wrap, and then as well the Tunnel and Bridge Company, which owned the old Second Narrows Bridge, provided a representative. And it took about a year and a half to get the study finished, but when it was finally published, it revealed that the increase in the population, et cetera, would require two bridges in 20 years. They did suggest where they would go, but they thought maybe one at the Second Narrows and maybe the Twin Lions Gate as well. So the two bridges at either end of the inlet. And of course there wasn't the money to build both bridges, right? So, they started on one, and they thought that tolls would pay for that over the ensuing 20 years, and then they could start the next one. And the reason Ghilardi and Bennett chose the second Narrows rather than twinning the Lions Gate was that twinning the Lions Gate had its own set of problems. They wondered where they would land the span at Stanley Park, and of course there was an outcry about damaging the jewel of Vancouver, which was Stanley Park, right? And the Georgia Street was already choked at capacity at that time. Apparently 2,000 cars an hour at peak traffic times were going through that area, and you couldn't add to that by putting another three or four lanes in there. So the second Narrows was obviously a good option, and it also would provide an industrial access to Vancouver, because the east end of North Vancouver was also being looked at by companies to build, you know, factories, and as you know, they're still there in boat building, chemical plants, etc. So the second Narrows was a good fit on several levels.
And so the Dominion Bridge Company, they were contracted to build the bridge by whom? The provincial government, was it?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it would be in the toll authority, which was set up to build bridges, and build and finance bridges in the province.
And take us to the 17th of June, 1950. What day was that day of the week?
That was a Tuesday.
And you were nine, and you remember that day?
Yeah, regularly. I was just about nine. I was a month away. I don't remember. I remember coming into the kitchen of my house after school. I guess I was delayed from school. I don't know. Though I guess school would probably get out around 3 o'clock. But anyway, so I came into the kitchen. My mother was listening to this very intense newscast, and of course she said, shh, you know, and listen to this, and so we listened, and then later, I guess a few days later, my father drove us all down to have a look at it. But I definitely remember that day, and it was a brilliant, I don't remember this, it was a brilliant afternoon, that part I researched, obviously, but it was 25.9 degrees C. There was a slight wind from the west. It was an absolutely brilliant day. The men were, you know, stripped down to their whatever singlets. They were all wearing their life jackets, but they were wearing the minimal clothing because it was so hot. And it was almost quitting time. It was an hour away from quitting time when the bridge fell at 3:40. And, of course, Gordy McLean had just delivered one of the cords, which is one of the large pieces of steel that weighed about 95 tons. He just delivered it to the end of the span, which they call the working part of the span, or it's called the front end, sorry. And he had just delivered this 50-ton, or this, this cord was 50 tons, not 95. Some of them were 95, but this one was 50. He had just moved the locomotive out to the front end with this 50-ton cord, and the traveler was getting set to pick it up. It was already, the swings of the traveler were already hooked onto this piece. It actually wasn't lifted yet. But I guess the weight of that extra 50 tons on the end of the bridge just tipped span 5 over and crushed the falsework underneath it, which was the temporary structure holding that span up until it reached the next tier. And so it was a surprise to everybody. Obviously, and there were the men described various scenarios. Some of them thought they dropped a few centimeters. Some of them thought they dropped 3 meters. And I guess it depended on where they were standing on the span, on how they dropped and what they thought of the, what they thought of the accident. And of course, the noise was deafening. The bolts on the tie plates, which was holding span 5 to span 4, they just shattered or burst, were sheared with explosive reports, and to the point some people thought there was an explosion on the bridge, and they thought it was sabotage. So it was kind of interesting that was sort of the theme when the Royal Commission started. Ferris, when he was, interrogating people, was followed that theme about the competency of the various people on the bridge and whether it might have been sabotage or not.
And then from your reading of it, the people that were building the bridge, the people that designed the bridge, they were all competent in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And how long did the collapse actually, it was 6 seconds, was it?
6 seconds, yeah.
And there were 18 people that died, is that right?
18 men died, 14 iron workers, 2 engineers, an operating engineer, and a painter. And then probably 2 or 3 days afterwards, the rescue effort claimed the life of a diver. Now, that diver was named Len Mott, and you can still see pictures of him because he was the stand-in for Peter Lorre in that movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which was probably filmed in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Lorre didn't have any diving skills, so Len Mott, who was a ticketed diver, was the diver in that film. So you can actually still see him.
You talk to survivors who were there at the collapse. You mentioned something earlier, and perhaps you can expand on that. What was it like to fall off the bridge?
Oh, well, obviously, you know, you've been in an elevator, and a lot of your readers will have been in an elevator when it sort of takes a dip and everybody thinks, oh, you got that hollow feeling in your stomach.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they felt. They didn't actually, you know, think about it until they were actually in the water because it was too quick. You know, 6 seconds and you're trying to stay upright in the air. And one of the iron workers, Colin Glendinning, who is now passed, that he said, he was thinking, I wish I had a parachute. And when Jim English, the bridge superintendent, went down, he thought to himself, you know, the bridge engineers had assured us this wouldn't happen. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. They weren't actually thinking about themselves in a way. They were thinking about, some of them were thinking about, you know, this shouldn't have happened, right? But very quickly they found themselves in the water, and because the iron workers were wearing tool belts that weighed about 60 pounds, they went right to the bottom. And that, in some instances, that was like 40 or 50 feet. And, of course, if they were knocked unconscious before they hit the water, they likely drowned, and that's a lot of the deaths were drowning. And, in fact, Phil Newton told me a story about when he was one of the rescue divers. When he was going over the site, he looked down in the water. He was in the water, and he looked down. He saw 2 iron workers half-standing with their arms sort of waving out in the current, their hair waving as if they were in a sports car, you know, and the wind was blowing their hair. And they had obviously drowned, and they were just crouched on the bottom there. They'd obviously been knocked unconscious in the fall and had just drowned. So, yeah, it was tragic. But most of them had no recollection of falling. You know, it's something that is just, they have recollection of obviously being in the water, gulping salt water, blood flooding into their mouth because a lot of them bit their tongues and, you know, slamming into water from about 50, 60 meters up is much like hitting concrete, so I'm told. So,
this Royal Commission that came afterwards, did they come to any conclusion as to whether this could have been prevented?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that in the epilogue I talk about basically just a précis of the things that went on, like inadvisable engineering practices. The column formula, believe it or not, the column formula that they used was flawed. There was complacency with respect to false works and how false works were considered pieces of equipment and not part of the structural steel. So the same sort of emphasis or importance wasn't placed on inspecting them. And that was very interesting to me because parts of the false work were actually fabricated. They were actually part structural steel. But nobody paid much attention to them because Dominion Bridge had never had an accident with them in the last 25 years that anybody could remember. And, you know, visually, people looked at the false work every day and nobody noticed there was anything wrong with it. And there was also problems with the beams, the I-beams, which were part of the false work, were poor with respect to crushing strength. So there were problems that the Royal Commission discovered at many, many levels, beside the dimensional errors that the engineers made. There were all sorts of issues that, and of course, the big one was that Swan Worcester, the consulting engineers, they didn't check the plans for the false work, because they figured, as you know, Dominion Bridge had never had a problem, right? And Dominion Bridge had been working with Swan Worcester for many, many years on many projects. And so nobody bothered to check it. And, of course, if they had checked it, they would have discovered the errors, and, yeah, it would have been prevented, sure.
And the future of the bridge. We always hear about them wanting to traffic and so on, that there needs to be, I guess, either twinning or more crossings, perhaps. Well, what's the future of the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge now?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think it was in, remember when the Lions Gate was redone? Just they changed the floors?
In the 90s or so?
Yeah, just a few years ago. Well, when that study came out, there were 9 crossing options that were identified in this report. That was one of them. That was the one that was the cheapest, was just to replace and widen those lanes a little bit, replace the floor of the bridge. But there were other options, and some of them were tunneling. Some of them were twinning the Lion's Gate. There were all sorts of different things. But one of them that Peter Buckland told me about was adding a lane to the Second Narrows. I believe that's what he told me. And so that would have adding a couple of lanes, I guess, on either side, which would have brought it up to 4 lanes going north and 4 going south. There's nothing been done. I haven't read much about other crossing initiatives since then, so I'm not sure exactly what the province are thinking. But, you know, if you've been on the North Shore, I'm not sure if you live here, but if you've been on the North Shore during rush hour traffic, I sort of bring this out in the epilogue, that what Hal Denton, who is the head of the Ratepayers Association, I think it was the Seymour Ratepayers Association, said in 1955 or something, stands today, and he said the traffic situation is beyond a joke. And, you know, I'm not saying it's beyond a joke, but it's pretty close to that. You know, if you have a meeting in Vancouver and you've got to get over there, you can bet your bottom dollar that there's a huge lineup up Trampolano to get onto the Lions Gate, or that, you know, there's traffic all the way up to Lonsdale to get onto the second, the Iron Workers Bridge. So, yeah, I think it's, we have to address something soon.
Eric, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. This is a great book and a fine tribute and service for everyone involved.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. And, you know, if I could say one thing on closing,
yes,
is that when we go by these men and women that are on construction projects, you know, even if they're you know, just waving you down and with a stop sign, you know, traffic people, etc., give them a little wave and a thank you, because they have dangerous jobs, you know, just like the iron workers on the bridge, people that work in construction and work on our infrastructure are special people. And they, you know, they do this, they go out every day in all weather and they fulfill a great job for all of us in this province. And I think we don't pay them enough attention, frankly. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is because I wanted to celebrate the lives of the men that built that bridge.
Indeed. Continued good luck with the book, Eric.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's a real pleasure to be on your show, and then maybe we'll meet one day.
Thanks very much. The book is called Tragedy at Second Narrows, a story of the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge, 3295, from Harbor Publishing. Eric Jameson on the line. I'm Joseph Plunta.